You're listening to a podcast from 702.
Eusebius Makaiza
on 702
for the curious.
I'm delighted to say that I'm joined by a South African that has spent quite a bit of time in North America and is an excellent global health expert, particularly around many of our concerns here in South Africa that she's familiar with as a doctor and as a professor, such as HIV and how we deal with that, both socially but also medically. And of course, in the current context in relation to COVID-19, there are many lessons to be learned, how it is that a country like South Africa has dealt with that particular public health crisis. And quite apart from that, there are also exciting projects that she is, with colleagues of her, spearheading in terms of trying to find all sorts of answers to this horrible pandemic that is afflicting our countries across the world. I'm speaking about Associate Professor of Global Health at the University of Washington School of Public Health, as well as Metin, Associate Professor and Dr. Ruan Barnabas. Ruan, good morning to you, and thank you so much for joining us here in your home country.
Thank you so much for having me.
Can I start on a personal level? How are you getting on? There's a lot of psychosocial challenges for all of us, doctors included, public health experts included, and being an expert on the subject matter doesn't necessarily mean that you are immune to how horrible it is just socially and mentally to have life as normal being disrupted. How are you getting on?
Thank you so much for that question. It's true that the pandemic has many far-reaching consequences. And at the start, I was very focused on the medical consequences, just the capacity of the hospital and being ready for patients, stopping surgeries that were elective. And then for my own training, learning everything I could about the virus and what I should do for patients. But as the weeks have worn on, the toll of having my family cooped up at home and doing homeschooling and just a real sense of loss, of missing our community life, of being with other people, of sharing events, of celebrating birthdays. Those things are hard to deal with for everyone. I did read this interesting article that said, what should we do? Should we thrive under this situation or should we perish? And they said that this was kind of a false dichotomy, because we're never really going to do either. We just have to do the best we can each day. So just like everyone else, we at home are trying to do the best we can each day to maintain our good spirits and be grateful for all that we have.
Absolutely. Now, you're involved in some really exciting cutting-edge research, asking some pertinent questions about how we may respond to COVID-19 that I'm delighted we're going to be able to share with my audience here based in Johannesburg. But before we do that, I want to ask you a broader question. I hope it's not too awkward. Science in America is such a politically fraught matter to try and navigate. We see, for example, on the daily briefs, how the likes of Dr. Fauci and Dr. Birx have to navigate the politics of Donald Trump. And yet, at the same time, there are excellent individual schools like the ones where you are at, many, many colleagues that you are collaborating with in a multi-site clinical trial. How hard, difficult, or somewhere in between is it to do really important evidence-informed scientific research right now, when there is so much peddling of fake news, misdirection, and so much corporatism with which many companies and politicians come to science publicly?
So certainly there's been a lot in the news about COVID-19, and not unexpectedly so. But this administration has made it clear that evidence and clinical trials should go on and are important for giving us answers for how to prevent and treat COVID-19 and how to interrupt transmission in the community. I also have received many emails from people appreciating research, encouraging us to move forward, and I'm grateful for that. And then, of course, the strong foundation that science has in providing evidence for public health. So I feel encouraged by colleagues and individuals and many people, including trial participants, who are focused on having clear evidence on drugs and other mechanisms to prevent and treat COVID-19.
Now, Professor Barnabas, you're familiar with two acronyms that roll off South African tongues because HIV/AIDS is particularly prevalent in sub-Saharan Africa. And those two little acronyms, which are critically important in how we deal with HIV here, include PEP as well as PrEP, post-exposure prophylaxis and pre-exposure prophylaxis. And that's quite apart from treatment if you were to be found to be, of course, already living with HIV and you were to test positive. One thing that's really exciting is whether there's the possibility of post-exposure prophylaxis that could be developed in response to COVID-19. What developments in that regard are being tested, and and how exciting is the pace with which that is being tested?
So post-exposure prophylaxis is really exciting because we would be able to stop disease among people exposed to someone living with COVID-19. So if you are in a household with someone living with COVID-19, or you are exposed at work or in a different setting, and the person didn't know that they had COVID-19 at that time, we are testing whether you could take a drug within 5 days in order to prevent acquiring COVID-19. And this would prevent the transmission of SARS-CoV-2, as the virus is known that causes COVID-19. And there are several studies ongoing here in the U.S., a few studies, including one in Minnesota among healthcare workers, a study in Spain that is a household and healthcare worker-based study, studies that are starting in Toronto and Singapore, and one here based in the U.S. out of Seattle and New York, and New York University, that are that's based at seven sites across the U.S. And that study aims to disrupt transmission using the drug hydroxychloroquine, which is one of the first drugs reported to have activity against SARS-CoV-2 in the laboratory.
Now, that drug has become almost infamous in public discussion in terms of whether it's, how it's being peddled politically and by one or two corporates. I don't want to get into that. I want to understand, as a mere liberal arts student, what is it about this drug that even in on a sort of prima facie basis makes it an interesting drug to respond to? How does it work in very simple terms when it comes to malaria? What does it do to the body? And why might it even be a drug that one explores in the context of COVID-19, regardless of where the research might take you?
Great. So the mechanism of action for hydroxychloroquine against SARS-CoV-2 has been well described and was one of the most exciting things at the start of the coronavirus epidemic that we found scientifically. What it does is, this is the postulated mechanism of action. So we think this is the way it works. We don't know for sure, and that's why we need these clinical trials. In the laboratory, the drug changes the pH of cells and makes it more, makes the virus less likely to penetrate the cell. In fact, the virus does not have good penetration of the cell when the pH is different. And then it affects the viral transport mechanism. So the it decreases the virus's ability to attach to the cell, step one. Step two, it decreases the virus's ability to enter the cell and be transported by endosomes. And then step three, through this mechanism, it stops the virus from replicating within the cell. And this is the way the virus spreads from cell to cell and causes disease. So if we can stop replication, we can decrease viral loads. And that way, it's very similar to HIV. It can decrease the SARS-CoV-2 viral load in the same way that PEP or PrEP would decrease a viral load for HIV and prevent replication of the virus.
That is really, 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 really interesting. How does one go about deciding where to put the monies, like the research grant that you are have been given and working with on this kind of research? What are the prospects of a vaccine as opposed to a cure being found, or you know, looking at post-exposure prophylaxis? You know, as lay people, all we want is something that gives us some sort of immunity. Yeah. Are you guys, as experts across the world, just exploring all avenues Or is there likely to be more prospect on some of these research programs, including ones you're not being involved in, where, as we speak, because it shifts on a day-by-day basis, is some of the more exciting work being done?
It's tremendously encouraging to see all the work being done on multiple facets for COVID-19 prevention and containment, including excellent work being done on the epidemiology and the impact of our mitigation strategies, including physical distancing. So lots of work being done to understand which aspects of physical distancing are important, what role do masks play, what role does limited contact play, is 6 feet apart really enough? So lots of good, very practical research going on in epidemiology. Mm. Lots of work being done on a vaccine. I think everyone recognizes that a vaccine would be really one of the key ways we could go back to life as normal, is if we had widespread safe protection. And then several studies, I talked about some for PEP, but there are also studies for PrEP that are ongoing. And there are multiple treatment trials. I think the last time, when I checked last week, there were over 100 trials that were registered on clinicaltrials.gov testing a mechanism for prevention or treatment of SARS-CoV-2 or COVID-19, including some using drugs we've talked, a drug we talked about, hydroxychloroquine, and other drugs, azithromycin, and then also exploring some drugs that we use to treat HIV, like Calitra, Lopinavir, Ritonavir. There's an ongoing trial looking at Ritonavir, Darunavir, and we expect that more potential agents will come on board. It's also nice to see that the trials cover the full span of testing early disease, and then we have several studies ongoing for patients who are admitted and have more severe disease with drugs that are harder to use, injectable drugs, and then some novel therapies using antibodies as well and agents to decrease the body's inflammatory response. So yes, there are, everyone is working hard across the full spectrum from epidemiology to vaccines and everything in between.
That's really exciting. You mentioned some properties of some treatments for people who are living with HIV or might already have AIDS, but hopefully once we get someone on treatment as soon as possible, they haven't progressed from HIV to full-blown AIDS. And I wanted to talk to you about what lessons can be exported, learned for the entire universe, really, but particularly from Africa in terms of how to fight the virus. And I wanted to start with a drug question. On the possibility of post-exposure prophylaxis, are there any prospects, Professor, of the antiretroviral drugs themselves biochemically, and you'll correct me if I use wrong medical terminology here, providing us with some sort of cover potentially? And what I mean by that is one of the things that seem to be not yet fully understood is whether living with HIV is a comorbidity in the context of COVID-19. And I have spoken to one or two HIV clinicians who said to me, there are some interesting early position papers in the last few weeks alone that have tried to start investigating whether or not aspects of the antiretroviral treatment that HIV patients are on could potentially be the basis for post-exposure prophylaxis, even for healthcare workers. Now, that's not necessarily in the public domain because one needs robust data, but I thought to myself, this is fascinating. We know that there are clear comorbidities, such as if you already have an underlying lung disease, for example, if there's if you are a cancer patient and your immune system has been severely compromised. But the intuitive assumption has been that if someone is living with HIV, they're probably in a risk group. But if they are viral suppressed and on treatment, then maybe not. So that's one part of my question. But the other is also over and above that, the spectrum of antiretroviral treatment drugs that are available, I wonder whether they could be an interesting avenue of research in terms of boosting the body's ability to fight back against COVID-19.
Yes, so both excellent questions. We don't know yet whether having HIV itself is a comorbidity for severe COVID-19 infection. We do postulate that probably if you have HIV and you are not on treatment, because you are at risk for many infections, we expect that COVID-19 will be one of them as well. But people who are on treatment and have reconstituted their immune system, it is possible that this gives them good protection against COVID-19 in the same way that it gives them good protection against other infections like toxoplasmosis or PCP pneumonia, many infections and that also caused chronic diarrhea. All those infections decrease with antiretroviral therapy. And so it is possible that we will see the same with COVID-19, that as long as your immune system is reconstituted, you're taking one pill once a day or your medication every day, that is really sufficient to prevent severe COVID-19. For the question of whether other drugs such as lopinavir, ritonavir, or ritonavir, darunavir, drugs we use to treat HIV, could they work as PrEP or PEP or even as a part of treatment, those studies are ongoing, and that will be very interesting to see, because we have the capacity to make those medications and distribute them, and we have all the experience from HIV, understanding how to rapidly scale up large public health programs. So that combination we would be in a good position to respond if that did prove to be the case. But we really don't know yet, and we absolutely need to have the evidence. We need to test it in a rigorous way using the right science as quickly as possible to figure out what we need to do to prevent and treat COVID-19.
If you've just tuned in, I'm in conversation with Associate Professor Ruan Barnabas, who's also a medical doctor and based at University of Washington Schools of Public Health and Medicine, doing some fantastic work as a professor in global health, including some really, really interesting work in relation to COVID-19. And we're very proud of what it is that she does as a South African, gifted to the entire world, a specialist in HIV here back home in our region, and now transplanting some lessons from there. The last 3-4 minutes, I want to devote a little bit more to some of the sort of community-based work that I know you feel very passionate about, Ruan, and see where there are lessons to be learned here. What broadly are the kinds of lessons, for example, in terms of getting into communities, uptake of treatment with HIV, that can be learned in the context of COVID-19? And I ask that partly because I would have thought, given how highly infectious this novel coronavirus is, that the way we have had to grapple in South Africa with TB, drug-resistant TB, multi-drug-resistant TB, that it's even more infectious within communities, that, not to say that HIV, it's not exactly an Olympics of disease here, but that particularly the way we've had to deal with TB and our communities and families socially would be even more ripe for learning lessons in terms of how to deal with a challenge when you have a virus that is highly infectious and people may be scared, may not want to come forward for treatment, etc. So talk to me about both HIV and TB in South Africa and what we can learn from trying to deal with those.
Yeah, so the work that we have done in partnership with colleagues and communities in South Africa is really what led me to work on COVID-19 in the first place. And the most important lesson there is that there has to be real partnership between community members and scientists. This has to be science embedded in the community for this to work. All the key stakeholders have to buy in to the science and be part of the program in order to understand transmission of viruses and to deliver effective programs for treatment and prevention. So that the key there is really good relationships within the community and a culture of inclusivity, being able to really hear what people are saying, have a safe space for people to talk and take that on board in terms of the response, so that partnership with the community is really clear and key for the next steps. We also learned that having a client-centered approach for HIV is what works. We recently conducted the DOART study, in which we provided treatment within communities from mobile vans, and it was possible within the study to not go to the clinic at all, that you received your treatment in the community. And we have another study ongoing where we are delivering treatment to people's homes. That study is actually still ongoing. The Department of Health has asked us to keep it going because it decreases the risks for people waiting at the clinic for their medication. So we do home delivery for medications and do visits with the providers over the phone. And that's exactly the same mechanism we're using for our trial for PEP. So we are conducting visits for the study by video conference, and we are delivering boxes with medication and with the swabs for testing to people's homes. They collect the swabs themselves and we pick them up for testing. So this study operation was inspired by the HIV work that we have done in South Africa and by other studies in Seattle, including the Seattle Flu study, which uses a similar mechanism. So putting the research and then treatment and prevention in the hands of people for whom it is most relevant, this client-centeredness and community partnership are key lessons from HIV and TB that we will need in order to mitigate and prevent COVID-19.
There's an interesting resurgence of a problem in the context of HIV that we've had to do enormous work to try and deal with, and I'm not sure whether we've slayed it entirely, but we certainly, the world over, are far better equipped to do so now than where we were at in the early 90s, and that's the question of shaming and a sense of self-shame for living with HIV, Ruan, and as you know, in Witness to AIDS, for example, Edwin Cameron writes about that enormously well, how stigmatization can really be itself a silent vector when it comes to the spread of HIV. Some early reporting just in the last week or 2 years in South Africa is that in some communities, across our communities, and it's not race or specific to where you live in the city, if someone is known to test positive with corona, people respond to them in all sorts of ways that are eerily reminiscent of early responses to living with HIV. Just reflect finally for me on that social dimension. So we've got to work with communities, but it's also interesting that we may be back again with self-stigma, self-shame, and shaming of the other.
So it's been key for infectious disease interventions and treatment for us to recognize that infectious diseases don't choose people to infect. There is nothing specific about an individual that puts them, that results in them having infection or being susceptible to infection. That humility in the face of infectious diseases could really affect anyone. It doesn't matter who you are or what you do is key. And in fact, it's one of the reasons we have had, for example, early on, we actually had quite good care and treatment for infectious diseases in prisons, because everyone realized that everyone is susceptible to ending up in prison, because the political landscape at that time was so uncertain that we really needed to have safe spaces and we needed to have a safety net for everyone. Both the stigma around having infectious diseases and kind of the self-righteous indignation that we have as community members, we need to set aside. This is a time for compassion, for recognizing that anyone could be infected or affected by coronavirus disease, and it's an opportunity for us to bring forward the best in our communities. As we have seen, lots of people are reaching out to help, to check on people. And that is really encouraging, to help people who really shouldn't be out grocery shopping, stay at home and do their grocery shopping. And so the best response we can have is an extension of that compassion and care for other people. And of course, there is self-interest in that as well, because if we have a society where people are able to come forward and receive interventions that they need, we're all protected. So our success in treating and preventing coronavirus is not only up to scientists, it's also how we as a community prioritize this and work to care and prevent COVID-19 among our fellow community members.
Professor Ruan Barnabas, fascinating. Love the work that you do. We're enormously proud of it, and we're going to look forward to see how some of this research unfolds. Thank you so much for joining me on the UCBS Makaiser Show.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.